Support for Father David Abernethy and his ministry at the Pittsburgh Oratory of St. Philip Neri comes entirely from the donations of community members and listeners like you. The creation of future groups and podcast episodes depends on your commitment and generosity. We humbly ask that you consider a monthly gift of $10 to the Pittsburgh Oratory in support of Father David and his work. To make this or any gift, please visit www.thepittsburghoratory.org, click the Donate button, and write Father David in the notes section. You can also make a recurring or one-time donation directly through Podbean. Your commitment and ministry-sustaining support are greatly appreciated. God bless you, and enjoy the podcast.
Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Okay, welcome back to the Ancient Christian Writers series, and we're picking up with our reading of St. Isaac the Syrian, and we're starting a new homily tonight, homily 76. And so we're on our last two homilies, and the focus of this one is on mercy. You know, how is it that a person who has dedicated his life to stillness, and in a kind of absolute way, then fulfill the gospel called to mercy and love towards others, compassion towards others. And then the final homily will focus on humility. And so two very, you know, certainly very powerful themes for these last two homilies, and not surprising that Isaac takes us there. And so we're on page 528. It is well that you brought forward from the gospel a comparison and an example for the investigation of the great discipline of stillness, as though we were opposed to it or sought to abolish it from something superfluous. The Lord defines the showing of mercy as likeness to the Heavenly Father, because it brings near to Him those who practice it. And this is true. Nor do we who are solitaries honor stillness apart from mercy, but as far as possible we strive to be far removed from cares and turmoil. It is not our wish to refuse to do necessary things when they present themselves, but to make stillness our only concern, that we may be constant in converse with God, whereby we are most able to filter out our turbid waters and draw near to tranquility of mind. If rarely it should happen that for a time a certain necessity as regards the brethren should come upon us, we must not neglect this. So he already begins in this first paragraph to say that those who embrace this particular life of a solitary, of an anchorite, are called to this in a radical and absolute kind of way, that they are not engaged in the typical ways of interacting with other people as we would be, and some of them not even on a minimal level. I mean, they would live so far out in isolation that they wouldn't have contact with others, but rarely. And so this is the focus of their life, that fidelity to this call is to seek intimacy with God at every single moment. And it's in this that they find the fulfillment of the gospel, including the fulfillment of the command to love others and to be merciful, and not in and through the things that they do physically, but in and through that radical communion with God, who is all mercy, that they are caught up into that reality in such a radical fashion that their love for humanity, as well as their prayer for humanity, becomes radical as well. And I think we have a hard time, again, wrapping our mind around that, because our focus is often on that which is active. means through which we can help others, and rightly so. I mean, that we would be attentive to the sufferings of others, of the poor, those who are sick, and caring for them. So of thinking of a way where one's communion with God would be so radical that our love and mercy, or a person's love and mercy, would take on that quality of God himself, that they would share in his mercy and his love for all of creation and for every human being. And so this is where Isaac is heading, but not, as we will see, to the exclusion of breaking away from stillness in order to for a greater good. Thus we constantly compel ourselves at all times to be inwardly merciful to the entire nature of rational creatures. For so the Lord's teaching instructs us, and it is not by chance that it is this which characterizes our stillness. It is needful not merely to preserve this inner mercy of ours, but when the time suitable for works and certain necessities require it, we must not neglect to give evident proof of our love. This is especially true for those who have not chosen total stillness, that is, not to meet with any man, but who hold to the rule of stillness throughout the week or for periods of 7 weeks. Such men, when they are within the confines of their rule, do not restrain themselves from fulfilling the works of mercy, unless there be one who is extremely abrupt, coarse, and inhuman, who wishes to practice stillness before the faces and eyes of men. We know, however, that the mind cannot be illumined by converse and love for God apart from the love of neighbor. So those who embrace stillness to a certain measure, you know, for a spiritual discipline for a certain period of time, maybe there would be those for the season of Lent, for example, who might embrace absolute solitude or for a period of time, a number of days. But because they do not embrace this stillness as a vocation, as an absolute for themselves, and because they also have the means through which to care for others, you know, certain physical goods and things like that, that they have that responsibility to be attentive to others in mercy. And they cannot use the stillness of their prayer or that time of prayer as an excuse to absent themselves from the care of others. And so I think these are good distinctions because, you know, Philip Neri had this little saying, leave Christ for Christ. And so whenever the bell would ring, even if they were engaged in deep prayer, they would heed the call of the porter to come down and hear confession or to engage someone. And so even if a person embraced a discipline for a certain period of time, the greater obligation is that of love and of mercy that trumps all. And so he would have the responsibility. Otherwise, he would be feigning a kind of religiosity, that he would be acting very much like the story in the gospel that we read on Ash Wednesday, you know, to be seen by others, embracing this kind of discipline to be seen as you know, having this kind of love and desire for stillness or being prayerful, but when this need for mercy arises, not responding reveals their true colors, that they haven't understood the meaning of stillness, let alone have understood the meaning of the gospel. What sagacious monk, possessing food and clothing, can see his neighbor hungry and naked, and will not give him whatever he has, sparing nothing? And again, who upon seeing another who bears the same flesh as his own, wasted by illness, exhausted by hardship, and in need of help, would prefer his role of seclusion to the love of his neighbor by reason of his ardent love of stillness? When, however, no such occasion arises, we observe love and mercy toward the brethren in our minds. But when the occasion is at hand, God requires us to fulfill and perform mercy with manifest works. So again, reiterating, you know, the need to respond and to respond fully, you know, even at the cost of giving away everything that one would have, which these monks would not have very much, but to care for the ill or for those who are in a radical kind of poverty. Hence, it is evident that we have not acquired possessions. We are not permitted to descend into cares and anxieties for the sake of the poor. But if we do have means, it is demanded of us. Again, if because of our way of life we are far from the habitation and intercourse of men and from the sight of them, there is no need for us to leave our cell, our solitary and secluded dwelling, and to give ourselves over to roaming throughout the world to visit the sick and busy ourselves with ministrations of such matters. For it is obvious that such a thing brings a man from a higher state to a lower one. Howbeit, if a man lives in the society of men and his dwelling is near to them and he's comforted by the labors of other men, whether at a time of sickness or of health, then he must render the same service. But he should not by any means ask others for such comfort. And if he should see a son of the same flesh of his own, who shares the same likeness to be in straitness, yea, rather Christ himself outcast and worn with weariness, and he should flee and hide himself from him, falsely imagining that he is practicing stillness, then he and those like him are without mercy. So, you know, those who would go into this deep seclusion often would have absolutely nothing or very little, you know, be living in a cave, you know, have the rags on their body alone that they would wear and would subsist off of the food of the land or whatever they could provide for themselves or find for themselves. And so, you know, certainly at that point, you know, their food is to, you know, be constantly directed towards God in prayer. And this is their, you know, work of mercy for even for the life of the church, to build up the church in that regard. And they are very much living at the heart of the church in this. And so that it is to be highly valued. And that's why Isaac can speak of it as being a higher way of life, a higher state. There are very few that are called to it, but nonetheless, those who are called to it have, in his eyes, chosen the better part, in the sense to give themselves over in complete love for the heavenly bridegroom and are focused upon him completely. But insofar as they receive any kindness from others, if they live closer or to others or in a group of solitaries even, and they receive themselves aid when they're sick or aid simply in food, then they have that responsibility. If they're living in community with others, then they have the responsibility to care for others and to show that compassion, to show that mercy in concrete, tangible ways, to ignore another in their suffering while it is seen directly, would be to ignore Christ himself. In fact, he identifies at the end of this last paragraph the individual who's suffering or ill with Christ. And so to turn a blind eye to such an individual would be to turn away from God himself. And so it might seem to be a subtle distinction to us, unless we grasp what Isaac is saying, that a person fully immersed in that union and communion with God is being drawn into that mercy, is being drawn into that compassion in a unique way, and that it takes hold of or embraces the world and all human beings with the love and the mercy of God himself. And so they are constantly, you know, at the heart of Christ and at the heart of the world. And again, this grace and this calling is reserved for a few. And they bear witness to this all-embracing love of God in a unique way for the life of the church. But again, it's a rare thing. And this should give us pause as well for all that we've read over the course of these years, and however much we esteem silence or stillness in our life and seek to possess it, you know, through the manner of our life, it can never trump mercy shown to those around us and those in need. That there are always times when that becomes our solitude, our care for the other. You know, that's the reality that God has called us to, and we should be able to make that shift without any hesitation, you know, as if we are moving from something, you know, better to something less, when in that state the two are equal. In fact, the showing of their mercy would even be greater at that point. And so he doesn't want anyone to have any illusions about what he's speaking about here, that, you know, stillness, silence is a reflection of the reality of the kingdom. And silence would be the language of heaven itself, the language of God, you know, that's that allows us to hear, you know, him, as we've said before, speak a word that is equal to himself. So to begin, it's already to taste and to begin to experience something of that heavenly and divine reality. And so it becomes important. The solitary becomes like an icon for us of the divine life. But again, you know, it is something to be, that we would see as rare, and so we wouldn't exalt it in a wrong-minded way. Because, you know, we can use our religious practices and our love for prayer as a means of avoidance, you know. And I think that's, you know, where Isaac is pretty astute, that psychologically as well as spiritually, we can use it to avoid our responsibilities or to avoid things that are difficult in our life as an escape rather than a movement toward reality. That ultimately our prayer should be the movement into the depth of reality itself, into God. But it can be used also, like we use so many other things in this world, as a kind of escape, a defense, that we're feeling overwhelmed by something and so escape into something. You know, for some it's food and for some it's worldly goods, but it can also be of a religious nature, or we could, you know, escape into silence precisely so that we don't have to engage the other, because there's something that asks too much of us, or that we don't want to give, or that's so painful for us. Yes?
I think I asked something similar to this like 3 or 4 years ago, but maybe it's been long enough I can ask it again. So, like, I always feel so conflicted when I'm thinking about or reading about like really tangible acts of mercy, you know? And, you know, I think about like Philip and the world he lived in, and it's like, you know, I mean, it's just the like corporal acts of mercy are like literally on the doorstep, and it's just like they're like right there. And I guess I'm just like how do we know, might it ever be the case that the Lord would desire for us to go out of our way to seek opportunities to exercise works of mercy? Or can we rely on his providence to bring those situations to us? Because, like, sometimes if you live in a city, then you might come across people who you can, like, maybe give, like, food. Like, you can feed and give drink to people. Very occasionally you can clothe them. If you work somewhere like here, then you're lucky enough to like get a few people a week who like have a, but like there are so many other situations, and like even here, it's like you maybe knock out 3 of 7, you know, like on a regular basis. And it's just like, sometimes I feel like, you know, we volunteer in this way or help in this way, but are we supposed to be carving out spaces of time to like, sometimes I wonder if like the corporal works of mercy aren't something kind of like a checklist, and we need to make sure we're checking each of those boxes at least once a month. And then, I don't know, I really struggle with that, because, and I know there's all these opportunities to exercise so many different kinds of mercy and kindness in our, like, my everyday life that I'm, like, nowhere close to being good at. And then I know there's, like, real moments where I actually encounter people who have material needs, but it's hardly, like, it hardly seems to be fulfilling the gospel precept if that is supposed to be taken as, like, a go find the people who need these things and do it for them. And it always just really bothers me, and every time I read about acts of mercy, I walk away feeling like there's something enormous that I'm not doing.
Right.
And yeah.
Yeah. I had a couple thoughts, you know, as you were talking there, and I think in our day and age, there is something different, say from Philip's time, as you mentioned, that the hospitals back in Philip's time were basically where people went to die, and the ability for people to walk in and, you know, offer to volunteer, you know, was certainly welcomed, because not many people would have wanted to do that. You know, it was not an easy task to clean and take care of somebody who's dying. And so, you know, it's not, as you said, as present before us. And so two things came to mind. You know, one is our busyness, that in some ways, I think the busyness with which we fill our lives can, in a similar way, be like the person who might withdraw into seclusion in order to avoid the world. Busyness can do that as well, you know, to lead us to avoid the things that are, you know, present before us, but more demanding of us emotionally in regards to our love, mercy, attention. So a person can work, you know, long hours and longer hours at the job, and be avoiding sort of the realities of the home life and the care of their families. And on another level, you know, I think that busyness too then can keep us from thinking about those who are out of sight, you know, and thinking about whether or not we are fulfilling the demands of the gospel, because we're so focused on fulfilling the demands of our work and what we feel is necessary to provide security for ourselves or give us the means to gain the things that we feel are going to be a source of happiness for ourselves. And these are very powerful kind of psychological pulls for us, you know, because we don't want to be bothered with those realities. The other issue, I think, is that we have institutionalized charity and mercy through government offices and agencies, and through maybe welfare too, you know, that you provide a minimal amount of financial need, but it's not necessarily engaging the whole person or the reality of their life. Elderly now are not part, the extended family is not gathered around together where the grandparents are living at home, and or aunts and uncles living in homes nearby. So the call to respond to part of your family or your neighbors, because we aren't as close to our neighbors, to respond to their need when they're sick provide their food, take them to the doctors, do their grocery shopping for them, that we live in such a profound isolation from each other and rely upon these institutions to take care of these things, that it gives us the sense of, well, it's taken care of, it's not my responsibility. If I don't see it, it doesn't exist, kind of thing. And so I think for the Christian in the modern age, it does require this ability to look at ourselves honestly and say, you know, even in my religious identity, am I driven more by the worldly mindset? You know, am I self-centered in my religiosity that I push these realities out of my mind? And do I make myself busy in all these ways? Or tell myself that I'm fulfilling the demands of the gospel in this particular way, but still that it allows me to avoid these other realities that would be more distasteful to me. And, you know, during this time of the pandemic, you know, I talked to a lot of people, and I know that there are so many who are living in isolation, the elderly in particular, that are on their own and have been on their own throughout this whole pandemic. And but they're forgotten because they're, you know, either neighbors are frightened, you know, and they're locked up in their homes, or family members are so far away that they don't want to come and infect their parents, you know, and so they stay away. And so then the individual ends up staying in their home watching the news all day, you know, and so the, you know, concrete sort of visual need has been, you know, so hidden and veiled, I think, for us on many levels, other than, as you said, the people that we see out in the street or those who come to our doorstep. The need is often veiled to us. The people are put in homes, or the government provides some certain amount of stuff, so we feel that we're relieved of that. And, you know, my mom still hears stories, and I heard her talking to my uncle the other night about my grandmother, who, you know, was this immigrant, you know, and, you know, didn't speak the language well. The family itself was rather poor and large, you know, 8 kids, and but the family would hear these constant stories about, and people would say to them that I would, like during the Depression, I would not have survived if it wasn't for your mother, you know, who provided them with bread and, you know, canned goods and things like that whenever there was need. And this was all done in sort of an unassuming kind of fashion. You know, somebody would show up at the door with a particular need, and she would provide for them. And but these were, you know, people from her town that she knew, and they all knew each other. And so I think you're right in asking the question, you know, can we safely assume anymore that it's going to be visible to us, or that we are fulfilling the demands of the gospel simply because we aren't presented with it as concretely as maybe Philip experienced it. You know, he was friends with Camillus de Lellis. You know, there's these paintings of Camillus with somebody over his shoulder carrying him, you know, and we know the circumstances of those hospitals were just horrendous, and the things that they had to do, but they did it. And I think one of the greatest fears of the elderly today is that they're going to be left alone, that they're going to find themselves in old age in complete isolation with no one to take care of them. And I think one of the fears of the young in our day is that they're going to have to take care of their parents, you know, or that they're going to have to step out of their life and disrupt it, and not just in a minor way or financially, but have to disrupt and make choices that aren't going to allow them to do the things that perhaps they had thought they would pursue in life or have the freedom to do what they want. And it's not, I'm not trying to be harsh here, but I think our culture has been taking on this shape and it's brought about this isolation so profoundly that it has made us turn in on ourselves. And so I think even the person who's striving with, you know, all their strength to live the Christian life has to sort of ask the question that you put forward. You know, can we assume this, or do we need to go out looking, or do we have to think through it in such a way that we're making this concerted effort to attend to those that are more hidden?
I feel like in the gospel, Christ says, you know, the whole story of like people at the judgment and saying like, when did we, and I feel like the emphasis there is like, when did we see you, Lord? Whereas now it's like, when did we see you? Like, you weren't there to be hungry or thirsty or, like, we don't,
yeah.
Like, I mean, I know, like, you know, 5 or 6 people who live around Oakland, but, like, I don't know. It's just so, like, I don't, you know, I feel like these, Providence does bring these things into our life, and then, you know, we're sort of presented with the question of whether to respond to them or not. And then I feel like if I'm not one of the, you know, Sisters of Merciful Jesus down at the Red Door, that I'm not actually living the gospel. And like, I don't know, I'm like, am I living the gospel? Like, as I am with my like normal job and responding to the people who like come across me.
See, it's so funny you said this though, because I was just having that literal, like that exact gospel quote. I brought that up, I think it was last night. I was talking with my wife about it. I forget what I was reading something. I think I read something out of a book on like St. Cyril, and I just can't remember what it was, but something made me think about that exact, that phrase on when, you know, you did this for me when, right? When did I see you? And I was thinking this was intensely like practical, what we just read, because I look at it and go, you know, I see my kids around all day long, and it doesn't mean I ignore them. That's not at all what I mean. But I mean, you know, there are just times where you're just tired after 12 hours of I need this and I need that and I need this and crying and fighting. You're just like, just stop screaming at each other and all this stuff. And it's like, but it's even the little things like, you're thirsty for the third time in a row and I gotta go get you another drink. Well, right there, you were thirsty. But I didn't see you because I saw myself and I wanted to tune you all out for like 10 minutes. I'm not asking for much. I just want my phone for 10 minutes so I can not read about nerding football or something. Like, I mean, just it's like total mindless, right? And it's not even necessarily bad. It's just like, and that's the sneaky thing. And it's just so funny because that was the exact same conversation. It was like all these times where we think like, well, is it bad or is it not bad? I'm like, or is it just we miss the point like so freaking often that because we're caught on degrees of badness all the time or something. Maybe I'm speaking a little personally, but I'm just saying, like, you know, and it's like, how often do I like just miss that person who's just right there because it's not screaming in my face and my kid doesn't look like the poor person begging for food all the time, or my neighbor, I don't take enough time, not that I maybe have to know them all, but just the one right there. How do I, you know, do I really take any effort to do it, or do I just like miss the point that they are that person? Not that there can't be other ones, but that like they are the ones that are around me all the time. And it's like, the point you just made about like the way things are set up, it just made me think like I live in a suburb, and I don't know, maybe there's nothing wrong with that, but like in a normal year, so go back to 2019, I wake up, I get in my car, I drive to work. And you can say what I just said and apply it to all these instances, but you're kind of just like going from like location to location to kind of location. You're like in your own bubble in the process of doing it. You're not like, there's very little opportunity to even come across the person that you're kind of like describing there, because I'm driving from my house to the office with five stoplights in between or something, and then I'm just running people I work in and back home. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's just different, you know? Like, you really are, you, like, suffering has been so far removed that you can be like, oh, yeah, there's people, there's the elderly in the nursing homes, but, like, it's actually weirdly not easy to even remember that, you know? And you, it's like, this
and
is
it's
so much effort to go
easy
there.
To help them.
Exactly.
Or like no soldier dies alone. I mean, we have all these hospitals with all these people who are dying alone.
Yeah.
And yeah, like if it was literally like, get a book or something beautiful and come and sit with this person, that'd be one thing. But it's clearance after clearance after clearance, and then you have to be interviewed, and then you have to be approved, and then you have to have this schedule and a coordinator. And it's just like, why can't I just go sit with this person who happens to be dying like right now? It's crazy.
Yeah. There, well, I think that's what I was saying in terms of the institutionalization of things, that when there are Catholic hospitals, you sort of didn't have to worry about that. You could go in and you didn't have to worry about religious things, saying religious things either. And you're right, like at Shadyside Hospital, we had talked to them once about, you know, training people and having them go in to sit with those who are ill and read to them and things like that. But it was this whole process. And it was only, you know, it was very even sort of limited amount of times that they would be able to do that too, that it was so constraining that it was almost seemed impossible for us to think about doing it. And even if you go to the, like as an undergraduate, we went to the soup kitchen almost weekly. And they had so many volunteers there though, because immediately one's mind moves to that, and this is a very, you know, select group of people too, and with various problems and things like that. But it's often not, again, those who are more hidden kind of existence. Simone Weil, I think we brought her up here a number of times, said, you know, one of the more important and neglected virtues is attention, and we don't even think of it often as a virtue, you know, of being attentive to the other, of being able to step out of ourself and engage those around us in a more direct fashion. There's a elderly gentleman who comes here, and he is just a great guy, and he dresses in such a way and holds himself in such a way, and he's elderly and sort of dignified looking. So he either gets confused as being a doctor or a priest, and he takes communion to the sick at hospitals, and a hospital in particular. And sometimes he'll say, you know, when he'll go in, he says, oh, Father, thank you for coming. And he says, I don't correct them, you know, because at that point, you know, because they're tearing up. Or he'll, you know, and he'll, oh, my glasses are hanging down my face here, and I didn't even realize it. Why didn't somebody tell me that? See, no charity among you. My glasses are hanging off my face and nobody tells me about it. But, you know, he'll say a prayer for them and they'll burst into tears. Or he'll offer a blessing, not as a priest, but, you know, say a blessing over them, distribute communion. And he sees in them, you know, this profound need and how grateful they are. But how rare that is and how difficult it is to find people to do that. Where in the past, you know, there were Catholic hospitals, there would be a multitude of priests who would be able to serve as chaplains, and the sisters, you know, giving this, you know, very close care spiritually and emotionally too, and now often, you know, people are in isolation. And yes?
I have two comments and a question. So my first comment was something we posted often that St. Charbel said about listening to people so intently or even listening with your hands. And I think about that often, like the degree of attentiveness.
Listening with your
hands. He talks about the attentiveness, for example, within the family or within the home.
Right.
And to listen so much that you're even listening with your hands.
Right.
And then maybe I'm mistaken, but I think didn't Mother Teresa discuss a similar phenomenon of the loneliness of people who even are within our own homes?
Loneliness of people.
Like the loneliness of people who are even within our own homes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And to be attentive to that. And but then my question
is, myself and I.
My question is, you know, so my thought was to Saint Theophan and our discussion of his writings. And I remember earlier, in one of the earlier letters, there was a discussion about her being attentive to what was present before her, not to be distracted by seeking what's out there, that's a distraction for her, and that her focus ought to be on kind of what presents itself providentially.
Right.
So how would you comment on that, given everything else we've talked about?
Well, I think the idea that charity begins at home, that, you know, often it would fill the mind to run out and like to externalize it. And not that that's a bad thing, you know, to seek out those who are in need, but often we can neglect those right underneath our nose in terms of caring for them. And so, you know, I think that does hold true. Charity begins at home, to be attentive to not only the physical needs, but I think the emotional needs of those that we encounter on a day-to-day basis. And I think we're living, you know, even before the pandemic, we were already living in bubbles. Mm-hmm. You know, we were already living in this profound isolation. It didn't take wearing a mask to do that for us, or having to stay home, because we were staying home all the time anyways, and we were sort of absorbed in our phones and things like that. And there's some ways even that the pandemic, you know, broke us out of that in terms of engaging people more directly and calling them and, you know, talking to them. And so where was I going? What was the question again? Okay, yes. You know, not going, right under your nose, as St. Theophan was saying, that he didn't want her, you know, to live in this reality that she was creating out there, to abstract, turn the gospel into an abstraction or to externalize it, but to live it exactly where she was and then allow God to guide and direct her. If he guided and directed her, you know, to take on greater things, then great. But she's not going to get there by neglecting to love and show charity to those with whom she lives. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. So, you know, it's hard in our day. I think our immediate response to a lot of people that we encounter throughout the course of a day is suspicion. Like, we put up like a wall because of all the things that are going on in our world. You know, I think we've become more and more guarded. And so it becomes hard for us to have that vulnerability to engage another person. Even walking down the sidewalk and you're passing somebody on the sidewalk to say, hello, how are you today? You know, sometimes it feels a little awkward because you don't know if that person's gonna think, who is this, you know, weirdo engaging me? You know, sometimes you pick up there's a kind of discomfort there, like you're going to ask them for something. Or
avoids eye contact.
What's that?
Everybody avoids eye contact.
That's right.
Except that's all you got right now.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. I read this. Sorry, I know that, but not to kill the point or keep bringing, extending the point, but like I read this thing. It was on a blog, Glory to God for All Things, and it was just recounting a story. It was amazing. It's just on the point of what you just said, though, on seeing each other with suspicion. And it was this whole thing about a monk who was a drunk his whole life.
Yes.
And it scandalized all the people that encountered him, because he was drunk every day. And when he died, they said to the elder there, they're like, oh, thank goodness he's gone, so we don't have to, like, you know, be scandalized by this anymore. And he said, when he died, I saw a legion of angels come and carry him to heaven. And they're like, what? And he said, because what you saw was a drunk, what you didn't see was someone fighting it over the course of his year. So he never defeated it, but he like continually fought it and made progress through it his whole life too.
That's right.
It's like the opposite of my thinking.
Right. It turned out that it was actually his parents, to prevent him from like crying, that they would give him like alcohol, a little bit of alcohol. So from the earliest years of his life, he became more and more dependent on it. So it was like he was formed to be an alcoholic. And as you said, he did fight it and reduce the use of it, but was never completely free of it. But, you know, still struggled in faith, to overcome the desire for it, as well as to be faithful to God in other ways.
But it is, it's one of those things where, like, I think you see people with suspicion, and, you know, there's the obvious ones, I guess, something like that. But even just, like, you know, just beggars on streets or something, you know, I've heard stories. I'm like, well, you can't even trust if the person's actually poor. People, and that's a sad, I guess, reality. The reality is, it's like sometimes I think we're more afraid of being taken advantage of than we are to actually just help someone, you know. And it's just. But those are like the obvious ways. This is the small ways that is like, I have a friend who's a sister of it out in the convent in Ohio, and she said hi to this woman at the grocery store this past year. She just said, like, hello, how are you doing, in the line at the grocery store, and this woman, like, just gave her a hug. She was like, nobody's really talked to me for 4 months or whatever because of the pandemic, and she was like, oh my gosh, like, you know, just all she said was like, hey there, how are you, and this woman, like, broke down, and I'm like, wow, I avoid saying hello to people in stores, like, I don't know, right, like, it's amazing.
Right. Did we answer your question, do you think?
Okay. That's hard. It's really hard. There isn't always someone to fall down their stairs and need help for 3 months.
I think, you know, when Francis was early on in his pontificate said, you know, that taking on the smell of the sheep, I think there was something about that, you know, to sort of break out of even like the religious bubble. And, you know, the distance that often exists even between the priest and those that he would serve, that how do you serve those that you really don't know, and perhaps for whom you have no affection whatsoever? I mean, it probably hasn't escaped a lot of people in churches that sometimes, you know, the priest finds, you know, his work to be burdensome, or that there's a quick movement, you know. And we even make a joke here at times. It's not probably not a good joke, but sometimes you get, we call it being front desked, that, you know, you come out of Mass. You've heard confessions, you come out of Mass, and you're going to go upstairs for evening prayer, you know, and like three or so people will grab you at the front desk to ask you questions. And so it's sort of like moments like that, you know, you really see what's going on internally, you know, that there is this need certainly to get to prayer and to follow your schedule, but sometimes things are going to come to you not when they're all that convenient to you.
There's also the reality that the sight of a collar reminds people of a million questions they didn't even know they had.
That's right.
And you're just like, can't do it, wait.
Well, I saw you, so I thought I'd go to confession.
Right, yeah, exactly. I saw you.
Well, we went pretty far afield there, but I think there is something important about that. And it often doesn't even come up, I think, in our groups. And we've been on the verge of it, I think, so many different times. But I think just what Isaac was saying here, I think maybe allowed us to think about it in somewhat of a deeper way. Does anybody know where I left off by chance? Do not bring forward John the Theban and Arsenius and say, who of such men gave himself over to works of this sort, or cared for the sick and the poor, so neglecting their stillness? Do not even speak of the deeds of such men. For if you are distant from all human comfort and intercourse as they were, the Lord will permit you to scorn such practices, but if you fall short of that perfect state, and at all times you are found in bodily labors and company with men, for what reason do you disregard the commandments that your measure is obliged to keep, employing as an excuse the great discipline of the saints, which in fact you have never even approached. So surprising, you know, again, after everything that we've read, how firm Isaac is being here in regard to, okay, we're talking about the saints who God has drawn into that seclusion for a reason, but don't use them as an excuse to absent yourself from the demands of the gospel. But as for me, I will not neglect the saying concerning St. Macarius the Great, which was recorded as a censure of those who despise their brethren. Once when he went to visit a certain brother who was sick, he went to visit a brother who was sick. When St. Macarius asked the brother if there were anything he wanted, he replied that he wanted a little freshly baked bread. He said this because all the monks of that place had then the custom of baking bread once a year at most. Straight away, therefore, that man worthy of blessedness stood up, and though he was 90 years of age, he walked from Skete to Alexandria 40 miles and more with dried bread laid up in his cloak, and he exchanged it and brought to the sick man that which he besought. So here, you know, it was a saint, you know, one who had certainly immersed himself in the discipline and the seclusion of prayer, and yet at the request of one who was ill, even in his old age, was willing to go to the great lengths to offer the small comfort, you know, some freshly baked bread rather than a bread baked a year ago, which is hard to imagine how it would stay edible. But so a beautiful story. And Abba Agatho, a man like unto the great Macarius, did something even greater than this. He was more experienced than all the other monks of his time, and he both honored and loved stillness and silence above them all. This wondrous man, therefore, went at the time of a festival to sell his handwork, and in the marketplace he found a foreigner sick and outcast. He then rented a house and stayed with him, working with his own hands and spending on him the proceeds of his labor and paying the rent of the house. Thus he served him for 6 months until the sick man became well. Abba Agatho, as it is told of him, was wont to say, "I should wish to find a leper, give him my body and receive his." This is perfect love. And so, again, curious, you know, after all these homilies, he's now presenting us with these examples of extreme mercy and compassion. As if to say to us, as beautiful as this is and as important as it is, that it does not outweigh the demands of love and of mercy. Those who fear God, O beloved, are cheerfully assiduous in keeping the commandments, even if labors are required to do so, and they imperil themselves for their sake. The life giver can find the fullness of the commandments in and made them to hang upon two which embrace all, the love of God and a love similar thereto, the love of his image. The first achieves the goal of the Spirit's divine vision, the second achieves the goal of divine vision and praxis, praxis meaning practice of the faith or a fulfillment of the commands. For since the divine nature is simple, uncompounded, invisible, and naturally not subject to want, the conscious mind in its meditation does not naturally require praxis, nor any sort of physical activity, nor gross material concepts. Indeed, its operation is simple, and it is active in one portion of the understanding, in a manner corresponding to the simplicity of that worshipful cause which transcends the perception of the flesh. So a person, you know, immersed in this kind of life of prayer begins to take on this quality of God, this simplicity, but that which is that transcends everything that knows corruption or limitation. The second commandment is the love of man in accord with the duality of human nature. Consequently, its observance is twofold. I mean that we invisibly fulfill it in our conscience, and at the same time we fulfill it with the body, and not only in an evident manner, but secretly as well. And that which is fulfilled by outward actions should be likewise fulfilled in our conscious mind. So in our deeds and in our thoughts in regards to others, that love and compassion should always reign, and in the prayers that we have for them as well, that this is always to be something that's active for us. What time are we at here? Does anybody? Still a bit to go here. Let's do one more paragraph. For as man was constituted from two parts, soul and body, so all things pertaining to him are accomplished in a twofold manner, corresponding to the duality of his nature. And because praxis everywhere precedes divine vision, it is impossible for a man to rise to that lofty portion unless he first fulfills by labor what is lower. Now, no one can dare to say concerning the love of his neighbor that he progresses it in it within his soul if he forsakes that part of it which is fulfilled by the body in accordance with his strength, the time, and the place which things aid him in doing the deed. For only then is that portion of love verified that is held and apprehended in the conscience. When in outward action we are faithful and true in so far as possible, then our soul is given power to stretch upward to that great portion of sublime and divine theoria, contemplation, in intellections that are simple and without form. But where there is no possibility to practice the love of neighbor in visible actions with the body, the love of our neighbor, fulfilled in our thinking alone, suffices in the eyes of God, especially if we are able continually to practice that all-embracing portion that is superior to the love of neighbor. So the divine vision, you know, if we're seeking that and practicing that and caught up in it constantly, like Mary's love for Jesus, you know, she had the bridegroom there gazing upon him, she had chosen the better part, that she was not to be pulled away from that because she had him right there. And so a person similarly that is wrapped in that and their whole life is absorbed in God and they're caught up in that relationship, then the fulfillment of that love, that demand of love, is complete. But insofar as we are in the world and we see others, then we have this responsibility in mind and body, you know, not just to fulfill it in our conscience, in our thoughts, but insofar as we can with our means and our deeds. So surprisingly, you know, this, you know, book on, you know, that we've talked so much about prayer and silence, that it's probably one of the most beautiful discussions, I think, about mercy and compassion. You know, he takes us to it so deeply and in such a refined way that it becomes difficult then to remain in our, you know, defenses, you know, and to hide behind them, hide behind our religious defenses. Especially when he brings out these examples of a 90-year-old saint walking 40 miles, you know, to get fresh bread. You know, it's sort of hard to say, okay, you know, I got to get back to my hut to pray here. You know. Any final thoughts before we close for the evening? Okay. Yes.
I can't find it, but he said something about loving God and loving his image, and it's like He's just so highlighting this, like, I don't know, I can't really say it, but this, like, you can't love God if you don't, or you can't love his image if you don't love God. But you can't say you love God if you don't love his image.
Right.
It's kind of a both and, mm-hmm. how they're complementary to each other. So while you know, and he's kind of like, kind of condemned the opposite of both. You know, don't just go out there looking for everything because it brings you to a lower state. But on the same time, don't just run away from everything saying, oh, I gotta pray or something, you know, because now you're just neglecting it and it's false what you're saying. It's just,
right.
it is like a really comprehensive,
right.
but succinct.
And there's something radically concrete about
yeah.
this. You know, it's not that our, you know, this idea that our mercy and our compassion cannot be something of the mind. And, you know, it compels us, again, I think, to look at our lives to say, you know, we can convince ourselves that we're being a good people, you know, that we're not doing anything wrong, and, you know, maybe even not, like, thinking ill of anyone, but perhaps not really fulfilling the demands of love, of the gospel, you know, not engaging others with this kind of attentiveness that involves, you know, the hands, as you were saying, you know, that in every way, you know, we are responding to them with our full self in the same way that we would want to engage God with our full self.
I think for myself, I'm just like still kind of in a place of confusion, which I'm okay with. Like, I'm okay, like, walking away uncomfortable. I know you like it when you walk away uncomfortable. But I don't know, sometimes, you know, when I'm going to sleep and I remember that, like, I have an immortal soul and I'm going to die and there's no way around that, and, like, I have to get ready for that because it's coming, I want to be the young man face to face with Jesus saying, like, tell me exactly what it is that I need to do to be saved, please, just tell me, because I'm like, I know I'm going to die. And I know this is what I need to work towards. So just, like, tell me what it is you want me to do, because I don't know. And then half the time I'm thinking about it, and I think about the parable of the, you know, of Lazarus and the rich man. And I'm always so struck by the beautiful, that, like, really just piercing, you know, they have Moses and the prophets, like, oh, no, Lord, but, like, if someone rises from the dead, they'll believe. And I mean, obviously, that's all about, like, Jesus is going to rise from the dead, and if they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, like, even if someone rises from the dead, they won't believe. And sometimes I'm like, oh, my gosh, like, what are the Moses and the prophets I'm not listening to? Like, am I acting as if I'm the rich young man standing here saying, like, Lord, tell me what I need to do? And he's like, it's literally there. And I'm like, but I just don't understand it exactly. Like, I don't understand how the New Testament, I don't understand how Scripture, like, sometimes I feel like I don't know what I'm supposed to do, like, 2 minutes from now. When I, like, get up and I go, and I'm like, am I supposed to, like, do some big radical thing, or am I supposed to go find some opportunity of radically assisting those in need? Like, it's just, I don't know. So maybe it's something I just need to, like, think and pray about for a while.
Probably help me carry this recorder upstairs,
yeah,
I think.
I'll do
that. Or tell me that my glasses are hanging off my face. That would have been a good place for all of you to begin.
It's just a hard thing. Sometimes it feels like it would be more simple to just be cast into a situation of total destitution where it's like there's no concern for your retirement account or your savings or how you're going to pay your rent or all these other obligations. Like, you're just surrounded by real need down in, like, the very dregs of life, and you can see so clearly what your response is because there's nothing nuanced about your life. And I just feel like I live in this, like, nuanced prison where, like, there's these responsibilities and they're good responsibilities and there's nothing wrong with them. But, like, to what extent should I distance myself from them a little bit so that I can attend to things that are more obvious and immediate?
I think
I'm just,
When Carol brought up earlier, though, what St. Theophane was counseling Anastasia, you know, the place we begin is those simple places right before us, right before our eyes, you know, that we don't have to do this radical thing that you're speaking of. The radical thing is just in the moment, being attentive to the other, having our eyes open to what God has put before us.
Yeah. I'm telling them when their glasses were falling off their face.
This is like hanging by one ear, you guys. Okay.
Well, can I just say one? I'm just trying to find a picture of it. I took a screenshot of it, but I read this post. I don't think it was yours, but it might have been. I don't know. It was attributed to St. Paisios, and it said, it's a big long paragraph, but the end of it is talking about divine righteousness, and it says divine righteousness is doing what brings rest to others. And I've kind of just been sitting and thinking about that, you know, just thinking about what does that mean to give rest to the other. And it just kind of reminded me of what you're talking about, just that I would think, especially in your position, you encounter so many others all day long that it's almost, there's a lot of people who probably would be grateful for any rest that you were able to offer them. And I was also thinking about your story in the grocery store. So sometimes when I go to daily mass, I go to the suburban church where they still do the sign of peace. So I know some parishes don't do that. And regardless of how you feel about that, the thought has occurred to me that exchange, even though it's from a distance and no hands are in contact, or, you know, it's just that eye contact and that wave may be the only contact that some of the people in that church have all day, especially in this time of pandemic. And thinking about it that way, it kind of took on a little bit of a different perspective in my mind. Right. That, like that lady that said she hadn't, you know, had an exchange with someone in such a prolonged period of time because of the pandemic. I think about that sometimes when people turn around, just something, that simple gesture of just making that little extra effort to make eye contact, or, you know, to just provide a little space for that person to rest with you in that moment.
I think it is as simple as that, and it can be profound. Okay. When we close, as always, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you. May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Go in peace. Thanks be to God.